I'm Claudia Hammond, and this is a download of All in the Mind, a programme originally broadcast on the 23rd of December 2014 on BBC Radio 4. Hello, today we're injecting a little magic into the show, the conjuring tricks which shine a light on how our beliefs affect the way we see the world around us. We'll be looking at the impact of hypnotism on our brains and finding out why spoons, or in this case keys, appear to bend before our very eyes.
What I'm going to try to do is to pass energy to the key through the fingers of my left hand, by passing through what some people call psychic energy and try to cause the metal to bend.
That's part of an experiment on magic and memory done by my guest today, Chris French. He's Professor of Psychology at Goldsmiths College, University of London, and he's head of the Anomalistic Psychology Research Unit, and he's spent the past two decades immersed in the psychology of paranormal beliefs. Now, Chris, why is it that we love magic tricks so much? Even if you don't believe in magic, there's still something we delight in having these tricks done on us. Why is that?
Well, I mean, I love watching conjurers in action. I mean, I think it's always intrigued me that you've got a situation where experimental psychologists kind of generally recognise that we can learn an awful lot about the way the mind works from visual illusions and other kinds of ways in which our mind plays tricks on us. We get very excited about an illusion where we might see one line as being 10% longer than another line. Now, compare that to conjurers who can make elephants disappear. And it's just so amazing that you've got a situation where they use techniques that can actually fool our perceptual systems, fool our memories, make us see things that we actually haven't seen, make us remember things that actually that's not how it took place. And I just love it. I'm a great fan.
So in your recent research, you faked a psychic performance where you pretended to be bending a metal key. Now, spoiler alert here, how do spoon-bending magic tricks work? How are people doing it?
Well, of course, this was made famous by Uri Geller back in the 70s. I was a huge fan of Uri's at the time. Took it all as at face value, thought it was all real. I don't know if you saw in the papers today, by the way, there was a little story about Geller. Apparently, he scratched his neck and his head fell off. forgive me. Very bad joke. That's the clean version of the joke, by the way. There are about at least 50 different ways to do metal bending. And when you describe it, it sounds so simple, you think it can't be just that. But one of the words is used very, very often and very effectively by skilled conjurers is simply to distract people. So you start with a straight metal object, you go through a lot of patter, you wait until people's attention is flagging a little bit, and then you bend the object. There are at least 50 different ways of doing this.
Now, in your study, you used a key, and some of the people in the study were also told that the key had carried on bending after it had been put on the table.
That's right, yep. We're interested in the power of suggestion.
Well, we'll find out what happened later on. Now, throughout history and across different cultures, people have believed that voices, messages and words could be channeled through an individual from another, perhaps divine source. You might have seen those beautiful Caravaggio paintings of St Matthew writing the Bible, his hand and his thoughts guided by an angel. More than 400 years later, modern neuroscientists are hypnotising volunteers and getting them to do what St Matthew seemed to be doing, automatic writing, but in a thoroughly modern setting, inside a brain scanner.
One of these paintings shows St. Matthew, inspired, writing the Bible, and the angel is holding his hand as it moves across the page. And it's uncanny that participants, 400 years later, and without us mentioning this, often reported the very same thing. It was as if somebody is inserting bits of paper with words written on them into their minds when they were writing. And we would be very interested if Caravaggio was here today. We would love him to see our results.
Divine inspiration or direct intervention. Later on, I'll speak to the researchers investigating automatic writing by hypnotising volunteers. First, let's have a look at how attitudes to hypnosis are changing. There's far more to it than the kind of stage hypnotism we might see in a show. Many medical professionals are training to use the technique, and some of you might even have been hypnotised at the dentist to have teeth out without any anaesthetic at all. But what about a major extraction, say a wisdom tooth? On a scale of 1 to 10, wouldn't that hurt?
Eyes open, wide awake. That was awesome. Yeah. Very well done. In the final moment of removing the tooth, there's a lot of pressure, and I would be interested just to know what number you were at.
Probably a 4-ish.
About a 4.
The final moment, yeah.
Without any form of pain relief, I would expect it to be, I would think, 8 or 9 without anything at all. So I think a number 4 is excellent.
That was Mike Gow, a dentist from Glasgow, filmed by the BBC earlier this year. And I'm joined by Dr. Peter Naish, who was president of the Section for Hypnosis and Psychosomatic Medicine at the Royal Society of Medicine. So, Peter, just how common is the use of hypnosis now within the NHS?
I don't think one could call it common across the board. It's still a small percentage, but it's not too hard to find. From GPs to dentists and in hospital settings. So it hasn't been left as a rarity any longer.
So what sort of things are people doing with it in hospitals other than dentistry?
It's very good for general calming. So for procedures like endoscopies, for example, or colonoscopies, something like hypnosis is very good for dealing with that sort of a patient. It's good paediatrically, especially if some sort of treatment is going to be rather painful.
Now, in the past, hard-nosed scientists were often very suspicious of hypnosis, and of course there are still some people doing it without formally recognised training. But have scientists begun to change their minds, do you think?
You're absolutely right. Not so long ago, there was a good deal of scepticism because it was very hard to find anything that in some way happened, some sort of phenomenon that occurred, just because someone was hypnotised. And in fact, people could act hypnotised so convincingly that even a skilled practitioner wouldn't be able to see the difference.
So is there something going on here, though? When someone's hypnotised, are they in an altered state of consciousness?
Absolutely. Whether it's an altered state of consciousness, there are still people who debate it more from a semantic point of view than any other. But all the evidence says, yes, it is something a little bit special. I think hypnosis is a situation where a person with a very versatile brain is getting it to behave in a distinctly different way, where an awful lot of the experiences, the conscious experiences, are derived from, let's say, internal machinations rather than fairly closely linked to stimuli coming in from the outside world. You detach yourself from conventional stimuli and seem to generate your own consciousness.
So let me clear up some very common questions about hypnosis. Can anybody be hypnotised?
Probably not. Most people are certainly influenceable. Some are dramatically so, and a few at the other end of the spectrum seem to be dramatically non-responsive. But in a therapeutic setting, most people can gain some benefit. Striking things like Mike Gow doing extractions, I don't think everyone could do that.
And so the people that can do it, these ones who are hypnotically suggestible, would those be the ones that when you see a stage hypnotist, they're the people who can be very easily persuaded to, you know, quack around the stage like a duck or do all sorts of stupid things?
They would probably be, but again, those would tend to be the extreme ones. The stage hypnotist, if he's lucky, will have a nice big audience. So amongst all those people, there are bound to be a few who are pretty dramatically responsive. But you don't have to be like that in order to derive clinical benefits.
So would you see it as another tool in a toolbox of useful different methods you could use with people?
Absolutely. And you've described it very, very well. It is a tool. It isn't of itself a therapy, really. It's pleasantly relaxing, and the well-being that you derive from it is likely to be therapeutic at a sort of low level. But principally, it should be perceived as a vehicle for delivering other forms of therapy, which is why it's ideal, really, that people should consult someone who is trained in whatever it is they need to do to you. And hypnosis is just one of the means they have of doing it.
In a moment, we're going to hear about a study where volunteers have been hypnotised while they're in a brain scanner, and then it's been suggested to them that an external agent, they call it the engineer, is inserting thoughts into their mind and guiding them to write down those thoughts. I wonder what it is about hypnosis that makes it such an interesting tool for researchers who are interested in learning more about what's going on in our brains.
I think you can answer that in sort of three ways, really. There are those who are interested in hypnosis itself, which certainly is intriguing. You can look at it from the point of view of consciousness more generally and say, if this is an altered state of consciousness, if we can learn a little more about it, in a sense you're also learning about what consciousness is itself, which intrigues, and it appears to be due to an interaction between the frontal parts of the brain and the bulk of the brain, which does all the work, which, like an iceberg, we don't have awareness of. But in hypnosis, we do seem to manipulate the interaction between the front and the more posterior regions. And the result of this is what we call consciousness. And a hypnotizable person, a highly hypnotizable one, seems to be very versatile in the way they can manipulate those interactions and produce strange effects. And this leads to the last interesting use that the researchers are beginning to move into now. And that is that a highly hypnotizable person can make their brain behave in the kind of way that a person with some kind of brain problem might do, a person who hallucinates or something of this nature. And when you see how the hypnotized person does it, you think, aha, this may well be what's happening in the patient. So very illuminating.
The study that I mentioned to Peter Naish was done by the hypnosis unit at the Institute of Psychiatry, Psychology and Neuroscience in London. They picked volunteers who were hypnotically suggestible and then put them in an fMRI scanner, a fake one first to get them used to writing while lying down, then into a real scanner while in a hypnotic state. Then they told them a third party, called the engineer, would be controlling their thoughts and their movements. How would people respond? It sounds terrifying, but apparently it wasn't at all. I went to meet the team, psychologist Eamon Walsh, neuroimaging expert Mittal Mehta, and consultant psychiatrist Dr. Quinton Dealey. It was Quinton who explained to me why they'd focused on writing.
What we're really interested in automatic writing and creating suggestions for automatic writing is to divide the process of thinking of a sentence ending and changing that so that people have the experience of thought insertion. So in thought insertion, you lose the normal sense of controlling or originating your thought. We suggest that it's inserted by an engineer from outside, so therefore you lose the sense that it's your thought and that you have control over it. And then in the movement stage, we make a suggestion that your hand is being controlled by an engineer remotely. And so that is what we would call, in psychiatric terminology, alien control of movement. So these are very interesting experiences for us to understand because they occur within the context of mental illness. For example, in schizophrenia, we call them delusions of control. But actually, they also occur in many cultural settings in historically a very widespread way, and they often occur within the context of experiences such as spirit possession or mediumship or prophetic inspiration or other kinds of revelatory experience, typically within religious settings. And of course, these are amongst the most important and valued experiences that people have cross-culturally and historically. So we're certainly not thinking of them as representing mental illness in any sense. But what we are trying to understand is what are the basic brain processes by which these kinds of experience are possible. And we're also interested in the question, of course, of what, if there are shared mechanisms underpinning at a brain level these kind of experiences, then what helps us to understand the differences between mental illness and between religious or other kinds of culturally influenced experience.
And do you know how similar the experience that the people have in the scanner doing this is to somebody who does, either as a religious experience or as part of a mental health problem, experience that same thing? Is it really equivalent?
Well, this, I think, shows the value of using what we would call an experimental model. Because, of course, when you're modelling something in science, you don't necessarily reproduce every single aspect of an experience. You're picking out certain important features of it and trying to understand them better. And in this particular instance, we're trying to understand the basic experience of control and the sense of ownership of thought and movement. Because, of course, these fundamental aspects of experience become altered within delusions of control in the context of psychosis, but actually also in many different types of religious experience.
So, Eamon, can you give me an example of what you do in practice once you've found the people who are suggestible?
So we chat with them for the first half an hour just to put them at ease, and then we invite them into a mock scanner environment where the lie down and the central tunnel are bore of a large machine, and we get them to practice. And one of the trickiest things, even before we get into the science, is getting people to write with their eyes shut, because it's not something we do in everyday life.
And why are you looking at writing?
Well, writing is quite fascinating. It's crystallized thought, and that makes it very interesting for us. You've got this fluid thought processes, but as soon as someone begins to write, it becomes crystallized.
So you put people into this pretend scanner and get them to practice writing with their eyes shut, and then what happens when you put them in the real scanner?
After the hypnotic induction, the participant is very relaxed, very calm, and hopefully they feel safe and reassured. And the experiment is very structured, so we train them beforehand to listen to the start of a sentence, so they wear headphones, and they will hear the start of a sentence, for example, the dog.
The sentence starts with the dog.
Then they must think up of a suitable, short, simple sentence ending and wait for a beep. When they hear that beep, they must then write down the short, simple sentence ending that they thought of.
Where do you do the thought insertion?
For this, we say, we want you, as before, to listen carefully to the start of the sentence.
The sentence starts with the television.
However, when you hear the start of the sentence, you will have the experience that an engineer is creating and inserting the start of a sentence into your mind. And another suggestion is that someone is controlling your thoughts as you write. Your hand movements will be normal. However, you will have the experience that the start of the sentence is being inserted into your mind.
What do people tell you about the experience of taking part in these experiments? Do they really feel as if their hand is writing without them and as if these thoughts have come from outside?
Yes, they do. Before we began running these experiments, we were very much inspired by a pair of Caravaggio paintings, which are around 400 years old. And one of these paintings shows St. Matthew inspired, writing the Bible, and the angel is holding his hand as it moves across the page. In the twin painting, you've got an older, wiser St. Matthew, but this time the angel is like a thought bubble poised above his head and whispering the words into his ear. It's a different type of inspiration. And it's uncanny that participants, 400 years later, and without us mentioning this, often reported the very same thing. Some people said that they felt like the engineer was holding their hand as they were writing. Or another participant said that it was as if somebody is inserting bits of paper with words written on them into their mind when they were writing. And we would be very interested if Caravaggio was here today. We would love him to see our results.
How might somebody end a sentence when you've talked about thought insertion compared with how they might end it otherwise, if you've got the sentence, the dog?
When we look at the behavioural data, by that I mean when we look at the writing, it's actually the very same. There is no difference. The number of letters is statistically the same. The number of words is the same. We even analyse them for meaning, content, imagery. These are all the same. What's crucially different is the brain activity.
Dr. Mittal Mehta, you're a neuroimaging expert and you're also part of this research group. And we've got in front of us some of the scans here with the results of these experiments. Can you explain what these show? We've got lots of sections through the brain there.
So these images show slices through the brain, and overlaid on top of that are orange blobs which show the changes in brain activity. Here we've got the thought insertion condition. We've suggested to them that the thoughts won't be their own. And what you can see is a reduction in activity in the brain during the movement interval. So that is when we tell people that someone else is introducing thoughts into their mind, when they go on to write the words and they know that they are writing the words, again, activity has changed.
So these are exciting results to see.
This is the first time this has been done, so we're really excited by this. And also, what gives us confidence is that when we do another condition, when we suggest to people that someone else is controlling their hand movements while writing, we see changes in brain activity which are actually increases, and they're increases in areas of the cerebellum and the parietal lobe, and that has been shown before. And so alongside that, the discovery of these changes during thought insertion become much more tangible, and we can relate it to these other changes.
Quinton and Eamon, this is exciting stuff, really, isn't it?
It is. We think it's interesting and important on a number of levels. At one level, of course, it's giving us fundamental insights into the sense of control and ownership of thoughts and movements, and that's important for understanding everyday functioning, but also illness and altered states of consciousness in religious context. But actually also it's pointing to the role of belief and expectancy and the power of belief in being able to reorganise cognition and experience. And it's showing us the brain processes through which that can occur. And that's quite fundamental because there's very little research in neuroscience which is addressing such a fundamental aspect of human beings as creatures that use language, as use symbolism, and that inhabit culture.
For me, what's very exciting about this is that up to now, scientists felt that you cannot really study thought. If you study a movement, you can see when it begins, you can see how long it lasts, and you can see when it stops. But try doing that for thought. Because of its implicit nature, its personal nature, you cannot study it. But we try to challenge that, and we try to say, well, this is a feeble attempt that writing is crystallized thought, but at least it's a beginning, and we're saying that it's possible, and it's the first small step on a long journey ahead of us.
Eamon Walsh, Quinton Dealey and Mittal Mehta. And Professor Chris French is still with me. It's a clever study, this, isn't it?
It is a clever study, yeah. And there's a lot in there as well. I mean, what they say about the kind of receiving of the messages, so to speak, very much corresponds to the way that mediums talk about the way that they pick up information. In some cases, they'll say that they don't know where the information comes from. It's just there. They're just tuning into something. In other cases, they actually do report that they apparently are hearing voices, you know. And again, it's a different, subtly different kind of process there. And also on the kind of the motor side of things, I mean, with respect to automatic writing, that's got a very, very long history. And I'm intrigued about how the findings from this study might relate to what's called the ideomotor effect, which is a kind of standard explanation for things like the use of Ouija boards, for example, or even dousing. Now, I think it's a subtly different situation because in the experiment we've just been hearing about, people are aware of the fact that they are moving their hands, or at least in some of the conditions. They did have other conditions there where they actually got people to reduce their awareness of their own hand movements. But in some conditions, people can be aware of the fact that it is their hand that's moving, but it doesn't feel as if it's them that's in control of the hand. In the case of things like Ouija boards and dowsing, people very often get the impression that they are not moving. In the case of a Ouija board, the wine glass or the planchette. In the case of dowsing, the dowsing rods or the pendulum. They feel as if it's some totally external force. But actually, we can be very, very sure that they are in fact moving, causing the movements themselves. They're just not consciously aware of their own muscular activity.
So they're not lying about it, they're just doing it completely unconsciously, pushing the glass across the room or a dowser and the dowsing rod starting to move. That they're moving them themselves, but they don't know they're moving them.
Absolutely. So you find if you kind of test dowsers, if you test them under conditions that are not very well controlled and they basically know what the right answer is, then you get the dowsing reaction. If you test them under double-blind conditions, then their performance typically falls to chance levels.
And you've used conjuring in your latest study. What were you looking for in the study? Why did you want to do it?
Well, what we were interested in looking at how people actually perceive and remember what's going on in these kinds of situations. So we showed a video clip of a conjurer, but introduced as being someone who claimed to have psychic powers, actually bending a key.
There's a bend emerging at the end of the key there. Bending a little bit more now, and it's a little bit hotter. And now it's starting to cool. I think that's probably as far as it's going to go this time. If I put that down on the table, that's something like a sort of 25 degree angle. And in fact, if you look at it now, it's actually still bending. It's still moving up. Still going. Yeah, that's it.
Now, in that clip, the psychic is suggesting to the volunteer that the key continues to bend after he's put it down and it's on the table. And half the participants in your study had the psychic say this to them. How does this suggestion that it carried on bending affect what they say they saw happen to the key?
Well, our study was based quite closely on a study carried out by Richard Wiseman and Emma Greening, using the same alleged psychic, who is in fact a conjurer. And the interesting thing is that for those participants who get the suggestion that the key carries on bending, then in Richard's two studies, 40% of the participants said they thought the key carries on bending. It doesn't. You know, you can be absolutely sure it doesn't. In the other condition where people don't get that suggestion, then virtually no one reports that it carries on bending. And so this is a really big effect with a very, very simple manipulation.
And your study had the extra layer of a third person, a stooge, who's also saying that they saw the key continue to bend or that they didn't see it continue to bend. What difference does that make, having someone else say they saw it?
Well, we were also interested in our study in what's called the memory conformity effect, where if you get a number of witnesses to an event, then one person's account can actually influence another person's memory. And so if that person's account is wrong, then they might actually cause someone else to remember something wrongly. And now what we did was to have our participants watch the video clip in pairs. And in fact, one of those pairs was a stooge working with us, who's been instructed by us to either say, yes, it did carry on bending, or no, it didn't carry on bending. And what we found was that we then got an additive effect. So the results of our experiment, we found that three factors were important. One, did you get the suggestion from the psychic or not? Two, did your apparent co-witness say the key carried on bending or not? And three, do you believe in the paranormal or not? And all those three had additive effects, so that if you were in the condition where you got the suggestion from the psychic and you got the reinforcement from the co-witness, we got to levels of 60% of people actually reporting they thought the key carried on bending. And I think what's important here is it shows that it's not just factors that are present while you are witnessing an event that can have an effect on your memory, but also things that come in after you have witnessed the event. Post-event information can also influence your memory.
And so what sort of implications could this have for our daily lives?
Well, I think it's got fairly important implications when people report in all sincerity that they have witnessed some kind of paranormal event. We can't necessarily take their accounts at face value. And typically, there's no other kind of more objective measure there. So we need to take those things with a big pinch of salt. We're not saying that we know that paranormal phenomena can't be real, but if we're only basing it on eyewitness testimony, we need to be extremely cautious. But I think it's got wider implications than that as well, because this will generalise to other kinds of belief. Political belief, for example, or religious beliefs, or even who your favourite football team is, it's going to influence how you actually perceive what's going on. And so, obviously, in a kind of paranormal context, you are much more likely to think you've seen a ghost if you believe in ghosts, even if, in fact, it's just your dressing gown hanging on the back of the door.
Thanks very much for joining me today, Professor Chris French, and enjoy any magic you might see over Christmas. Next week on All in the Mind, the people who hear music in their heads when they don't always want to, and the portrayal of mental health in the novel. I'm joined by the novelists Matt Haig and Nathan Filer. Do join me then. Thanks for listening to that download of BBC Radio 4's All in the Mind. To find out about other BBC programmes, including Inside Science, The Life Scientific and Frontiers, go to bbc.co.uk/radio4.